Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Rob McKeefrey, and this is episode number 287. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Truly appreciate those of you that like, share, comment. Just helps us continue to highlight the great people we have in our profession. Also, I want to thank our sponsors, and specifically InTech, for bringing these episodes to you for free. I only partner with companies that I believe in, both the people and the product. And InTech's got fantastic people. And great product that I have in my own garage gym. So if you're in the market, reach out to them. If not, you know, just let them know the next time you see them at a conference how much you appreciate them being a part of the show. This week I'm joined by a friend of mine, Jessup Coyne. He's the director of athletic development for Lindstrom in the Gold Coast in Australia. We got a chance to hang out a bit at the UFC Performance Institute when he was in town, and then again when he spoke at our Speed Mastermind in Melbourne. And just a great guy. He's been doing a little bit of everything. And appreciate you being on the show, man.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Joseph, I've mentioned a little bit. I mean, you worked in China. You've done a little bit of everything. Which one of your experiences in your background had the biggest impact on you and the coach you are today?
Yeah, so I'd probably say there's been two. One was doing a master's degree by research, and that was supervised by Jeremy Shepherd, and that was done at Surfing Australia. Basically, that was on the upper body, like upper body strength, yep, and paddling speed on a surfboard. So whether it's related to one another, e.g., if you're stronger, do you paddle faster? And then if you improve upper body strength, does it make you a faster paddler? So that really got me. That was a massive influence on me, just to sort of how you develop those questions around, I want to find something out here. And then also the influence of Jeremy on my sort of career and the doors that he opened for me were huge. The second one was I worked as a physical preparation coach for the Chinese Track and Field Federation for just under 2 years. And the coach I predominantly worked with was a guy called Randy Huntington, who's a big time legend in the track and field world, coached Mike Powell back in the 90s. And he also coached Woody Banks, who was also a triple jump world record holder from the States. But that really was a massive influence on me, and just how everything got tied together in the system with track and field and so on. It really helped me develop as like looking at the big picture of not just taking care of the strength conditioning side of things for an athlete, but taking care of the whole picture for an athlete. So the technical, the tactical, the everything. So yeah, big influences.
Sorry, I'm coughing, guys. I'm still trying to get over a little bit of a cold here, but yeah, you know, Randy is a good friend. I got to know Randy when he was, when I was working with the Cincinnati Bengals, and did quite a bit of work with us there. And Jeremy Shepherd actually is a friend as well. He spoke at our conference last year. He's speaking in the UK again for us this year. And just a dynamic personality, isn't he? Just a great guy.
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
I can imagine how those guys have had influence. You know, I want to dig into the sprinting and jumping, but before we do, I always like to ask, you know, what's the biggest mistake you've made as a coach, and how you've learned from it. I think, you know, being able to help try to avoid people's mistakes is what helps people get to where they want to go a little bit faster.
Yeah, sure. So, mate, there's been a number of mistakes, and it's hard to pinpoint the biggest one. But I'd say the thing is, the biggest mistake that I've probably made is trying to expect things to be perfect with athletes. And it's never going to be perfect. There's never a perfect repetition. There's, like people say, practice makes perfect, but that's nonsensical. Like it doesn't exist. Imperfect practice makes perfect. There has to be some degree of variation. You have to challenge yourself. Like if everything's perfect, then you're not challenging yourself. And then also there's only, everybody learns at different rates, and you can't expect somebody to go from a complete novice to expert in, say, a strength conditioning type setting, even though they're an expert in another setting, i.e. their sport, within a couple of weeks or a couple of days. They might improve a bit quicker than others, but there's still this rate of learning, rate of motor development that needs to occur. And you just got to be appreciative of that and take it into account rather than try and expect everything to be perfect in X amount of time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think, you know, being able to chase that is obviously, you know, the goal, right? But at the same time, you know, it's so important to make mistakes and learn from them and constantly be striving to improve yourself. So I couldn't agree with you more on that. You got a chance to work with Randy, and the guy's a sprinting jumping legend. You spoke for us at the Speed Mastermind. What do you think when you sit back, you've worked with elite athletes at that level. When you see what people are doing for speed or jump training these days, where are we missing the boat? What are people doing that you don't necessarily agree with? And what are some recommendations that you think that apply to every sport, every strength coach?
Yeah, sure. So I've got a kind of rule of thumb, and it's like, what would my grandmother say? And so a lot of times people will be like, oh, we'll get you stronger by doing squats, or we'll get you faster by doing squats, or we'll get you faster by doing vertical jump. Well, if you ask your grandmother if you want to get faster, she's probably going to say, well, you probably need to practice running faster.
Right.
So that's first and foremost. And then it's getting, from there, it's getting an understanding of how do you incorporate running fast into an overall training program. So obviously track and field is like the grandmother of strength and conditioning. Weightlifting is like the grandfather. But you should go and train track and field. Go and spend time with track and field coaches to get an appreciation of how they put it all together for their athletes. And then you can take those ideas or those principles and then apply it to your own setting, whether it be a team sport, like a court sport, a field sport. But you learn what they're doing, how they're fitting it in, what type of volume they're doing, and what there would be like the minimum volume you can use to right. get improvements out of people, and then take that and then put it back into your setting in the most appropriate way.
Yeah, I think that minimum viable product or that minimum viable solution is so important because, you know, again, unless you're in track and field where the actual event is, you know, essentially a test or essentially, you know, a skill, you're often trying to balance a lot of different qualities that you're co-developing at the same time. You know, if you're working with American football players or rugby athletes, you know, speed is a very important piece of the pie, but it's not the whole pie. What do you think that, you know, if you were to work with those team sports, if you're working with that rugby team, what does a sprint power program look like for you?
Yeah, like, so they've got to be doing some sprinting.
Right.
For starters. There's got to be some sprinting just to either, because it's highly likely in the sport, they're not going to be getting, when they actually play the game, they're not going to be getting to maximum speed or maximum velocity. So in the week somewhere, you've got to fit in some sprinting. And it's going to have to be around a day where they're pretty fresh, so maybe middle of the week. And they're also going to need a little bit of recovery afterwards as well for the neural system to come back. So the middle of the week might work well. But it depends on the individual. It depends on the physician. So are they a person that need speed in their position? For instance, some rugby players, they just, like rugby union, they just jog from one pile of bodies to another pile of bodies, fall on that pile of body, and then get up and jog to another one. Then right. they do a lineup or scrum and push a lot of that. So maybe it's not so important for those people, but for other positions, it might be very, very important. So yeah, you've got to find a way to fit it in, and then you can normally you would do strength training after the sprint. But you can do sort of power exercises to amplify or potentiate that speed training, depending on how your week is set up. So, for instance, we might do with us before a speed day. They might do some Olympic lifts, some light Olympic lifts, and some jump squats the day before, or even the morning of, just to potentiate that afternoon. Nothing that's going to fatigue them too much, but it just gets them going. Some weight vest jumps, something like that, just to potentiate the following session. So it depends on how much time you have in those programs and how it's all going to fit in the overall scheme. But maybe middle of the week, they're going to have to do some reps. A good rule of thumb for acceleration is the minimum volume would be about 100 meters. For maximum velocity, minimum volume would be about 200 meters, e.g. 540s. And so you've got to find a place to fit that in.
Yeah, I think that that's the challenge, right, is because you're dealing with several different positions that, you know, some, like you said, some guys are jogging from pile to pile, and they might, you know, get, you know, 60 meters of total sprint work in a match versus, you know, your forwards or your receivers that are going to be getting, you know, several hundred yards of max, you know, speed efforts. Or bouts, you know, what are you using as your marker for volume for what you're trying to hit in your training? Are you trying to exceed what they would be experiencing in the game, or are you trying to match what they would be doing, the demands of the position?
I would say you want to exceed it. You definitely want to exceed it, in my point of view. You want to give them a buffer of safety so that when they're sprinting out there in a game, they've got, like, it's a buffer, you know what I mean? They've gone faster than that in training. And then also, obviously, in a game, they're not going to be sprinting in a straight line. There's going to be slight change of directions. There's going to be reactions. They're going to have to anticipate. So all these things make it a little bit harder. And so you want to give them that buffer in a closed skill, straight line, linear speed before you go into so they can handle the sort of curvy, linear, slightly multi-directional type speed that they'll experience in a game. But when people start talking about it, and they go, and another thing that pops up a lot is that nobody runs completely straight. Like, there's no true linear speed in a game. But again, I go back to what my grandmother was saying: if you can't run fast in a straight line, you're probably not going to be able to run fast in a crooked line. So that's my sort of philosophy on it.
I love that a lot. You know, we talked a little bit at the conference about testing and monitoring, and just how, you know, I mean, you're coming from Australia, you know, where technology is coming out by the day, even, you know, in Australia. When you're dealing with that, if you're going to that team setting, that team sports type of setting where you're dealing with lots of different positions, lots of different athletes, what tests are you using, and what are you monitoring week to week?
So this is something that I think can really be improved on, and I actually put up a little Twitter post about this the other day. From Warren Young, kind of set the scene for me to go on a little rant. And Warren Young, if people haven't heard of him, he's one of the most original thinkers and sort of strength and conditioning, speed, like, really good. But you don't devote time to testing. You want to embed your tests within your training. So whatever you're going to be doing for training, figure out what you can test in your training and then monitor that and evaluate that maybe every 6 to 12 weeks. For instance, say you wanted a marker of upper body strength. You wouldn't do a day, waste a whole day of training time where you tested a 1RM bench press. You'll just get the guys started doing bench press and then use like a 1RM formula equation to kind of estimate their 1RM or velocity. If you're using velocity, the faster they can move a set weight, it's generally anything above, if they improve their speed by 0.02 milliseconds, it's going to go up. Their 1RM is going to go up by about 2%. So you can monitor it like that. And then all I do is I'll keep track of those numbers. And then every quarter or every 6 weeks, I kind of reevaluate where we are. And say, okay, well, this is where he's gotten stronger. This is where he still needs work. And then all my programming is based off that kind of needs analysis for what I think is important. I use radar graphs or spider plots and go, okay, this is how far away he is from the standard that I want in this area. But in the other area, he's far exceeds that. So why don't I just maintain that other area and really focus some time on the weak area, on the area that's not meeting standards? And so, of course, you've got to make sure that you're bringing a person's weaknesses up, but you've also got to keep their strengths as well. So it's a balancing act between what you're doing there. But on the whole, start of the season, general prep phase, it's the weaknesses, specific prep, you're focusing on their strengths. And so long as you have that type of philosophy around your monitoring, I think you can do some really great work.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's so, you know, it's so important and something that I've been faced with, you know, my career where, you know, you peak for these testing periods, you know, and yet, you know, you're peaking at the start of going into a season, but then throughout the season, you want them strongest at the end of that 16-week, 20-week season, you know, and oftentimes you're not anywhere close to that. But if you had these type of diagnostic type of tests throughout to monitor, you're absolutely right where you can give it, you know, give a little here to get a little bit more there or maintain a certain area, but, you know, focus on those weaknesses. And I think it's such an important thing, and using monitoring to do that, be it some diagnostic test or be it some technology, I think is an important process. When you're dealing with your coaches, you know, and you know, we both have worked in China and you know, where they're enamored by, you know, technology and the bells and whistles and things along those lines. I mean, when it comes to what you're actually turning in or how you're educating your coaches or interpreting that data, what have you found to work best for you?
Yeah, so I was actually going to get back to it. You sparked a little thing in my head right there, Ron. Sometimes you might want to use a testing day, right, although I said you're better off just incorporating into embedding it into your everyday training, but you might want to use a testing day just to get the athletes fired up and engaged. And if you don't, now athletes are so used to coming in and getting tested that they'll be like, something's wrong if we're not getting tested.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the case in China too, for sure. So they like to get a sort of, you go in there, you do like a little array. And I actually set up the COCs in my time with the COC before the Track and Field Federation, the Olympic Committee there. We set up a sort of testing system for them. But that's really big for one, actually giving them something physical and saying, look, this is where we're going to go with this. This is the plan. And just that process of involving them in that, I believe helps that overall buy. And it's a lesson I've learned, but to be efficient, eventually you want to phase them out of it and just monitor it, like embed everything in your actual training, so you're not wasting time so much. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, obviously, you know, the more that you provide that data to them and you know, spider graphs or those radar graphs or whatever it may be, I think also gives them a good visual representation of what you're trying to do as well. You know, you mentioned China. I know you've spoken around. I know you've worked with athletes from many countries, you know, to the strength coach that's listening that wants to work, you know, internationally, that wants to, you know, experience different cultures and work with different athletes, what advice do you have for that person to go into that situation prepared?
Yeah. So one thing we used to say when I was with Exos over in China was, it was China positive was like the slogan. You got to remain China positive. So you've got to go, if you're going to go anywhere, you've got to go in with an open mind. You got to appreciate the culture, appreciate the experience and appreciate the positive parts of that experience. Sure, there'll be things that aren't as good as at home or that are different from home. But in China, there's, for instance, you're learning another culture, you're learning another language. Those are the real benefits of it. You know what I mean? Take advantage of that while you're there.
Right.
And appreciate those things and focus on those things, rather than focusing on, oh, it's not as good as my hometown and wherever, and we did this differently back in the States or in Australia, and so they should be doing it like this. But they've got their own systems, and learn from what they're doing, and then add that to your skill set when you go back to wherever you're going to go in the future. But long story cut short, open mind, appreciate the experience for what it is, and appreciate the positive elements of that experience.
Yeah, I think that's such an important message, regardless whether or not you're working with a different culture or not. I mean, oftentimes you go into situations, especially as a young coach, where, you know, you got to chase the jobs early. You got to go to where sometimes you wouldn't necessarily, you know, culturally fit or want to be, to continue to advance. But you have to find the good in everything that you do. You know, you got to make the big time where you're at. And if you do that, you know, you do it with a positive attitude, oftentimes you're going to continue to make strides towards what that ultimate end game or that ultimate goal is for you. But culturally, yeah, I mean, working with China or working with, you know, Australian athletes or UK athletes or Mexican athletes, they've been almost different every single time, but they all want to win. They all want to, their home, their family are all important to them. And so finding ways to connect with them on a personal level, continuing to put goals towards what, you know, towards winning, it's not rocket science, but I think what you said there is absolutely right on point. What advice, I mean, you mentioned Exos, what, you know, is how you got connected over to China. What about, how would you recommend, coaches go about seeking out international opportunities?
Yeah. So look, I, how it normally works is that I got approached by a friend who was working for Exos and said, "Hey, are you interested in a job?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'd be interested. Sure. Why not?" And that just happened because of that connection. And that's how I guess most jobs eventuate. Obviously you can look on sort of the bulletin boards or the sort of NSCA, ASCA, Australian Strength Conditioning boards for over there. But I will say one thing is that, or another thing you can do is if you're going to go on an overseas holiday, maybe when you're going, this is one thing that I've done in the past, reach out to some people you might have a connection with and say, "Hey, can I spend an afternoon with you, see your work, watch what you do," like as a bit of professional development. And that's another way of, if you're overseas and from there, a job might pop up and that's another connection you've got over there, and that person will be, "Hey, I know Joe from Australia. He was interested in actually coming over here and working. Maybe he'd be up for this job." And getting in front of people like that in that face-to-face. But as a young coach for a career progression, I would 100% recommend going and working in a foreign culture. It'll make you rethink your philosophies, reevaluate how you deal with people, how you coach, and you'll come out of it a much better overall coach than if you just stay in one spot and you're just in one spot for the remainder of your career.
I agree 100% with that. Not only do you develop better your verbal skills, but oftentimes you don't have the ability to communicate in the same language. So you have to develop your kinesthetic and your visual skills as well when you're coaching, and it makes you a more well-rounded coach for sure. You mentioned earlier, you know, I don't know if it was on camera or off camera, but you've gone back to get your PhD, you know, and the importance of that, you know, at this point in your career. I mean, you've worked with elite level sports. You've worked in multiple countries. You've kind of put that on hold a little bit to kind of go back and continue education. Talk a little bit about the decision to do that and why you feel like that's important.
Yeah. So I just dropped the phone. Sorry. For me, it was something I'd always sort of had as a career goal or life goal, just to do a PhD. And then what happened after the Olympics in 2016, we had our first child, and it was really hard me working in China with the baby. And I was coming back and forth from China to Australia and it was just really, it was too hard on family life. So I was like, look, I want to go home. I want to spend some time with the child. And I've always had this ambition. I'd sort of started getting the PhD rolling And I was like, look, let's just focus on that for this next period of time. And I can do a little bit of work outside of that. But this is, that was a, it was a sort of an alignment of a lot of different factors that, that made me think, look, let's really get stuck in and knock this out.
What do you think that it'll do for you professionally? I mean, this is something that, you know, I mean, I'm finishing up my PhD as well. I think the more I've talked to more people are finding it more and more important to go after that, you know, that that advanced degree. What do you think that that'll do for you professionally?
Yeah, I don't know. Besides, it's an extra qualification. Two, it gives you a greater skill set in terms of your ways of thinking and skills that you can bring into a workplace. For instance, I'm doing a lot of mathematical work in my PhD, statistics and quantitative analysis, so borrowing a lot of things from financial markets.
And
using things like that and being able to apply it to a sports science type area, that's a skill that you can it's being a thief, right, from other industries. And that's actually a skill. The better you get at it, the better you get at stealing stuff from other industries. So you get this experience, you get to meet new people and be influenced by other people, e.g. your supervisors. Two, you get a qualification, and at the moment, like a master's level degree is probably the standard in strength conditioning. Soon it's probably going to be a PhD.
To stand out.
And then three, you get this like development of ways of thinking and ways of applying work. So that's what I hope it'll do for me. At the end of the day, the other reason why I did it, and I'll be completely honest, is I can't be a strength and conditioning coach forever. Potentially I might like to work in a university setting as a lecturer or supervising other students myself. So that was another thought for me.
Smart, very smart. Well, man, we end the show with some resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
Yeah. Can't sit on two horses at any one time. It's probably the best one. You might be able to ride one after another, but it's hard to do both at the same time.
That's great. I love that. What about a book, app, and website recommendation?
So my book that I give to or recommend to everyone is Top Dog by Poe Bronson. And not as well known. It's like similar sort of writing style as Malcolm Gladwell, Freakonomics type. But this is Top Dog. It's all about the science of winning and losing, and investigates all sorts of genetic components to competition, testosterone's influence on competition. Wonderful book, highly recommended. And it'll probably change a lot of how you coach people.
Wow. What about app and website?
App and website. The app I've been using most lately, I do breathing as an exercise in the morning. Like I've done a bit of Wim Hof stuff and a few other things. But I use this app called Apnea Trainer, which basically you set up as a with some breathing exercises where you hold your breath for certain periods of time, breathe for certain periods of time. And that would be the app that I'm using the most at the moment. It's a wonderful thing. And it's also another aspect of physical development and probably strength and conditioning coaches. This breathing is not well acted upon at the moment in our industry.
Oh, good. That's awesome, man. Well, brother, we got a chance to get to know each other through these last couple of interactions, and just I think the world of you. I think what you're doing is fantastic, and more importantly, watching you from afar and seeing the type of family man that you are, the husband, the father, I wouldn't say you're putting your career on hold to kind of to be that family man, but you're continuing to advance your career while being that guy. Is inspiring to see, and it's the right way to do things. And I'm proud to call you a friend, and appreciate you coming on the show.
No, Ron, thank you, man. It means a lot. I appreciate it.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.